Welcome to the Colorado Trial Lawyer Connection, where Colorado trial lawyers share insights from their latest cases. Join me, Keith Fuselli, as we uncover the stories, strategies, and lessons from recent Colorado trials to help you and your clients achieve justice in the courtroom. The pursuit of justice starts now.
Howdy, everyone. Keith Fuselli here, back for another edition of the Colorado Trial Lawyer Connection podcast. As you know, we try to speak with lawyers when they've had success and maybe sometimes failure, but usually success in trial to kind of find out what worked, what didn't work. And this episode, I am thrilled to have on Gabriel Stoops, who not only crushed his first jury trial, his first lead civil jury trial, but this was a Med-Mal trial. And for those of you out there who tried Med-Mal cases, you all know how difficult they can be. And to have that be your first trial and to be met with such amazing success, I am thrilled to welcome to the show, Gabriel Stoops. Welcome.
Thanks, Keith. I'm grateful to be here and grateful that I've got a positive report to talk about.
That is the most important thing. So, Gabriel, tell us a little bit about yourself. How is it that you came to be a trial lawyer?
I'm from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and my dad was a trial attorney. In fact, his specialty was medical malpractice. And I grew up hearing the stories of the clients that he helped at the dinner table. And so I knew from an early age that that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to join his practice once I got older.
He's in Oklahoma, I take it then?
Yeah, he was. Unfortunately, my plan didn't work out the way I intended. I went through undergrad as quickly as possible. I did that in 3 years so I could get out of law school as quickly as possible. And once I got to law school, during finals of my 1L year, my dad suddenly, tragically died. I, of course, was not expecting that and was kind of lost for a while after that.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, he had cancer, but he was not dying of that. It was sudden that that he did. So we weren't expecting it at all.
Wow. What a sort of one of those things that just has a profound impact on your life. Tell me a little bit about what you learned from him growing up about, I guess, the right way, maybe the wrong way to practice law.
Yeah, he was very disciplined and detail-oriented on his cases. And he would talk to his kids about the importance of talking to experts and doing medical research. And so he imparted each of those skills to me separately. And I didn't have the legal framework yet to understand it. But I knew when the time came, the separate components of the case that were very important to focus on and why they deserve so much attention.
So then I kind of take it from your background and your story that you always knew you were going to be a lawyer. Is that fair?
I originally wanted to be the crocodile hunter. And after that dream,
seriously,
yes, that was my first goal. And after I saw the hazards of that occupation, I decided law would be safer and better for me.
I mean, I got to be honest, I didn't even know there is such a profession as a crocodile hunter, but it does sound very dangerous. I'm taking while you're in high school, you realize I'm going to become a lawyer.
Yeah. And high school started a mock trial program during my senior year. And so it was an attempt at mock trial. They didn't have a plan. They didn't have a program, anything like that. They just kind of threw it together. And I joined that team and we went on to win state and ended up coming 14th in the nation. And so that was kind of an early sign that maybe this would be a good path for the skills that I have.
Holy cow. So you sound like a natural, even I can just tell in the way we're sort of chit-chatting that you're very comfortable speaking in front of people, comfortable in front of the jury. Assuming that's true, has it always been that way? Just kind of with your upbringing, just always feel comfortable in front of people like that?
I wouldn't say I feel comfortable. I'm glad it sounds that way. I think that I've learned to speak from my dad and listening to him, and I picked up along the way. And so that part comes naturally to me, but there's a lot of nerves for me. It's not comfort.
Whatever it is, it's working amazing. Where did you do your undergrad that you said you did in 3 years? That's impressive.
University of Oklahoma College of Law. The in-state tuition was too good.
Okay. So you did undergrad and law school at Oklahoma?
Exactly.
Yeah, my wife is from Edmond, so I spend a lot of time in Oklahoma. It's amazing the community, actually, of Oklahomans that are present here in Colorado. Lots of people.
That's something we have in common. My wife is actually from Edmond as well, and she's now my partner-in-law.
Oh, really? Okay. And have you always had your own firm, or when you graduated law school, how did it come to be with that you established your firm?
Yeah, I mentioned I was kind of lost after my dad's passing. I didn't know what to do. And in law school, they present a vision of success, which is kind of unilateral. If you're successful, you get in the top 10, 20% of your class. You can maybe get a position with big law, and that's really the best you can have it. That was what was presented to me. And so I tried to follow that path for a while. And I ended up getting a position at a big law firm in Houston, 2L summer associate position. And the assumption is that if you get that job, they give you a job offer afterwards. So like once you get there, you've made it. And so I was one of the highest performing summer associates, and then they didn't give me a job offer. And that was absolutely crushing.
Do you know why?
No. I talked to a bunch of partners afterwards, and one of them said, maybe you'd be a better fit at a boutique plaintiffs firm. And that meant nothing to me at the time. And for me, it felt like a personal rejection rather than just not the right fit in terms of what I want to do and how I approach the law and what I really care about in a case. Being from Oklahoma, the song Garth Brooks, he has a line that says, sometimes I thank God for unanswered prayers. And that's how I really feel about this, because I'm really grateful that that door was closed for me so that I ended up on a path to where I am now, which there's a little bit more to that.
Yeah. And I want to explore it a little bit because I had a similar experience. Although my experience, I went to CU law school and I was middle of the class, and I had friends that were top of the class, getting all these interviews, getting all these high paying big law jobs. And I was personally hurt. Like I couldn't get an interview. I couldn't get anyone to give me a chance for anything in the world. And to your point, that hurt. And so I ended up being a prosecutor out of law school for 5 years, which was amazing because I got the trial experience and kind of led me on the road that I'm at today. But more so than so many things in life, in law, that rejection often is something later on in life, you come back and like, wow, I am so glad that things worked out the way that they did. Although I'm sure in that time when here you are the highest performing, you know, doing a great job, and then you're faced with this rejection, I'm sure at that time, you know, thinking, oh, everything's going to be okay, doesn't make it any easier. Is that kind of what your take on that is?
Yeah, I was completely lost. I didn't know how to take that in a positive way. And to me, there was, you know, nothing good that could come from that. I just didn't have the ability to see that. And that's something that I can, you know, see in retrospect now. And I'm really grateful for that perspective now.
So how is it then that you mentioned that you're in practice with your wife? Did you both form and start the firm together?
So I graduated during a hiring freeze. I couldn't find full-time employment with any firm. And so I started doing contract work for multiple firms. But even then, I wasn't able to get enough work to feel like I was fully employed. And so I had the crazy idea, what if I were to see if I could bring in some of my own clients and start my own practice? But I had just moved to Denver. I was in a new city where I didn't know anybody during a pandemic where nobody wanted to meet anybody. So it was a bit of a crazy idea at the time. But I felt safe doing that while still having contract work to pay the bills in the meantime.
Okay, so this would have been, what, roughly 2021?
2020. November 2020 is when I started the firm.
Okay. And when you started the firm, were you doing sort of like anything that walked in the door? What kind of cases were you working on?
When I started the firm, my hope was just to get a client. I was willing to do anything that I could to build my way up. I didn't think that I had the privilege of being selective at that time. And so if I could make this dream work, then I would able, you know, build into the direction that I wanted. But it worked out surprisingly well that I started getting personal injury cases very quickly. And I think that's by virtue of the community here and really the need here, where there's a lot of people that need representation.
Mm-hmm. So other than personal injury cases, were you doing, you know, criminal defense type stuff or family law, or kind of anything? Or did it pretty quickly become focused on personal injury?
It very quickly became focused on personal injury. Other than that, it was just smaller disputes, property damage type things, because there's a lot of, you know, property damage cases that don't find attorneys.
Sure, sure. We already know, because I gave it away, that your first trial was a medical malpractice trial. Tell us the story about how you decided, because in my mind's eye, I'm thinking you're running this firm, it's relatively new, money's tight, and in comes a medical malpractice case that you decide to take. Walk us through your thought process on taking this case. Is it just, you just knew that it was righteous?
The client was struggling to find representation. She didn't have very strong economic damages. And so I think other firms were looking at this as a case that was risky and it was going to be costly. But when I heard her story, I felt very strongly for her. I couldn't stop thinking about it afterwards. And what really hit me about her story was that if this can happen to her, this can happen to anyone, because she did everything right. And so I wrote her an email saying that my faith in our society depends on seeing justice in your case. And wow. So I wanted her to look to see if there was another firm that would take up her case. And if not, I asked her to trust me with it. And I was very scared about that, but I didn't want to bite off more than I can chew. And so I told myself this would be the only medical malpractice case that I take until it's over. I wanted to focus my time on this case, and I also wanted to make sure that I proved myself a bit before committing to other cases.
Wow. So tell us the story, the story that resonated with you so much. What happened here?
So she had PRK surgery, which is a lot like LASIK. It's a surgery to improve your vision. It's supposed to be very routine. They tell you that, you know, basically nothing bad happens after the surgery and that the risk of complications is so small you don't have to worry about it. But she is one of those people that did have such a complication. And so she reached out to the facility. The surgeon was supposed to be taking care of her. And they just ignored her and ignored her and ignored her. And she was trapped because she was supposed to be under their care, but they weren't caring for her. And so when she went elsewhere, they tried to send her back to them. And that was what really got me, that you have a duty to this patient and you have to take care of them because other providers are looking to you as the operating surgeon to care for somebody after surgery. And that's what made her so trapped. And I don't know what anyone could have done in her situation to get help.
So what was the complication? And help us understand, because I think this episode, it might be useful to sort of dig into the weeds a little bit. Because as you're telling the story, I'm really curious to hear, you know, what the defense was, what your strategies were at trial. So give us a little more detail in terms of what complication arose and what she tried to do about it.
Yeah, and I'd like to give a little bit of the medicine to start. And that was part of my strategy at trial. I wanted to make the medicine as simple and easy to understand as possible so that the jurors wouldn't be confused by the defense. And so this surgery removes the outermost layer of the eye. It's called the epithelium. And it takes about a week afterwards for that to heal. And during that time, your eye is like an open wound. It's vulnerable to bacteria entering the eye and causing an infection.
Let me ask you a question. Yeah. When you say you were, because I am not at all familiar with this surgery, when you say they remove the outer part of the eye and it takes a week to heal, does it regrow or does it close? What is the healing process?
It's really just a thin layer of cells. It's not as dramatic as it sounds as I describe it. But it's important to understand that it's an open wound, that it's vulnerable. Because once you understand that part, you understand why it's important for the surgeon to be checking on the patient to check for an infection. Because an eye infection is a very serious emergency. They progress very rapidly, and they can cause permanent damage within 24 hours. And so in that context, you should be carefully monitoring your patients. And that's just not what happens after LASIK and PRK surgery.
So do they give you some kind of antibiotic eye drops or something that's supposed to keep out infection? Because in my mind's eye, as you're explaining this, I'm thinking it's almost like having an open cut on your eye. Infection can come in. So what do they do to try to prevent that from happening?
They give you a bandage contact lens as well as antibiotic eye drops. And then they assume from that point on that you're going to be okay. Because these are volume-based businesses where the surgeons are performing so many surgeries that they cannot possibly care for all of the patients afterwards. And so they're relying on statistics that say that the risk of infection is so low that they pretty much assume that there's no infection, even when you start complaining of symptoms of one.
Real quick question before we kind of go back to what happened here and the symptoms and whatnot. You mentioned that this is a volume-based practice, which is kind of what I was thinking when you think about these LASIK centers. And I'm jumping way ahead now, but was that a central theme in your case? Were you able to get the evidence that you needed to show how many of these surgeries they're doing a day in order to make it a theme in your case at trial?
It was a really precarious area for us because we didn't sue the corporation. And so we were trying to stay away from the jurors blaming the corporation. And that was also what the defense was trying to do and say that this, you know, if anything, is the fault of the corporation. And so I was trying to stay away from anything that blamed the corporation too much. So that wasn't the angle that I was taking it so much. But I also wanted the jurors to appreciate the context of how this happens and why this is something that I think we as a broader society should be more concerned about, because this didn't just happen in her case. The way they're operating, it's going to continue to happen, and it does.
So what happened? Walk us through a little bit in terms of what started happening with her eyes and what she tried to do about it.
So she had the surgery on a Monday, and 3 days later, on a Thursday, she was having excruciating pain. She was extremely light sensitive, and she was progressively losing her vision. And so when she had her surgery, they gave her a little sheet that had a number to call if you have anything unusual. And she called that number. She didn't get through to her surgeon, but she got through to the on-call optometrist. And so she was quickly fit in for 5 minutes to see him. And he told her everything looks fine. He wrote down that she was in extreme pain, but said that she was fine, didn't follow up, didn't notify the surgeon. So
both eyes, by the way, extreme pain in both
eyes. So that was day three. The following day, she had to go to the ER because she was in suicidal, worst imaginable pain. The ER doctors gave her fentanyl for the pain, and then they called trying to reach her surgeon. But the on-call doctor answered the call and said an infection is very unlikely and that her symptoms are normal after surgery. And so they discharged her from the hospital. She went home and just hoped to get better.
Now, to me, was that sort of the crux? That seems so negligent, that particular action, that particular call. Am I reading the room right that was sort of like, that is just so bad, that was the thing, or was it the culmination of all kinds of actions?
We had to rely on the culmination because there were a few problems causation-wise. One, we couldn't pinpoint when the infection actually started because they didn't actually examine her except for that 5-minute examination during a week-long period. And so we didn't have the data to say with certainty when the infection began. And as a result, we had trouble saying exactly when the damage was caused because that was all just unclear because they didn't do more. The other problem was that they never identified who the caller was that took that call for the surgeon. There weren't that many people that it could have been. And I pressed very hard on this during discovery, but they never gave an answer with any certainty. And so they were trying to shirk responsibility for that.
ER calls the treating doctor who says everything's fine. And that's, would you say that was 4 or 5 days post-surgery?
That was 4 days after surgery.
Just 3 days after she called, she was examined, everything's fine. Fourth day, she goes into the ER. They call and the doctor says, the treating surgeon says, no, everything's fine. Everything's normal. Day 4. So what happens after that point?
After that, she goes home for the weekend and she's been told that she's fine by the on-call optometrist. The ER didn't do anything for her. And so this was the most hopeless she's ever felt. She couldn't go anywhere for help because she's still under the surgeon's care and they're just going to call her surgeon and try and send her to him. But nevertheless, both she and her sister called the eye doctor's office over the weekend and they spoke to that same on-call optometrist. And here's where there's a factual dispute. He claims that he offered her appointments over the weekend to see her immediately, but that she declined because of the weather. She claims he did not offer to see him over the weekend, and instead, the best that he said was, if you call back on Monday, maybe you can get your first postoperative appointment moved up from the following Wednesday to the following Tuesday.
Wow. What then happened after, so we go through the weekend, she's miserable. What is occurring with her eyes at that point? Because I'm assuming at that point, the infection had set in.
Yeah, at that point, it's pretty much undisputed that there was an infection. It was very severe. And so the eye has the highest density of nerves anywhere in the body. An eye infection is the most excruciating thing that you can experience. And there's actually a strong link between LASIK, PRK, and suicide because of that reason. And so it's the worst imaginable pain in the place that you want it least. And she couldn't get any help. So she just had to hold on and get through. And so that's what she did. On Monday, she called. She got her appointment moved up from Wednesday to Tuesday. And that Tuesday was the first time she saw the surgeon after surgery, the first time the surgeon knew anything about what was going on with her postoperative care after surgery. And when he finally saw her, he prescribed half of the antibiotic dose necessary to treat her infection, and he only treated one of her eyes.
I guess let me back up. Up to that point, all the medical records would have shown that the pain was in both eyes.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. And so what was his justification, I guess, in his deposition as to why he only gave half of a dose of antibiotics and only treated one eye?
So the client had a few rheumatology diseases that he suspected might be involved here. And so he was treating this as a systemic immunological problem rather than an eye infection. And so he was treating her entire body with prednisone rather than giving her fortified antibiotics in her eye, because he thought that maybe those diseases might be causing what she's experiencing now. And he just wasn't certain that it was an infection.
Wow. So I'm flabbergasted. And if I'm understanding the facts correctly, there's a reason why my son recently had pink eye and, called it in, actually did a telehealth visit, script was called in, and there were the antibiotics she just dropped in the eye. So you're saying that when she went in and saw the doctor, he said, yes, you have an eye infection, but I'm going to give you like a pill, prednisone, to treat like whole body infection?
He said that he suspects an infection. And so he began to treat just one eye that he suspected more strongly. And there were lots of errors in the medical records where they didn't document things very well. And they were trying to hide behind that during trial and twist things so that anything that wasn't certain in the record, they would state a little bit differently or the way most favorably for them. But what we were able to really lock them down on was that the standard of care is antibiotics every hour. That's what the medical literature says. That's what we got every expert to say. And he said in the medical records that he prescribed them every 2 hours.
So he prescribed antibiotic eye drops into one eye every 2 hours. Is that right?
Right.
And the standard of care is every hour. And even if you suspect the infection is only in one eye, do you only do the eye drops into that one eye, or would you do it in both eyes to be safe?
Bit of a different issue. The evidence was really clear that there was infection in both eyes at that point. One thing that you look for is a collection of, you know, white blood cells in the eye. And he did document that on his eye exam at one point, but just failed to bring that record forward. And so the evidence in the record was there to support that there was infection in both eyes. He just didn't start treating it soon enough. And this goes to our theme. One of the themes throughout the trial was that when you only have 24 hours, it can't wait a week. And he just kept pushing it back 24-hour increments before he finally gave her the treatment that she needed a week earlier.
So did I hear you say that the record that proved that there was an eye infection in both eyes, the white blood cell count, that was that a difficult record? Did they try to hide that record or something?
It was at a different office. So they had different records. And then when we initially got the records, we just got an incomplete record that only had a part of that record. It was not in the traditional format. And so it took a while to put that into the sequence where it belonged, because even some of the dates were wrong. Like whenever they updated a medication, they would change all of the dates. And so many of the dates throughout the medical record were just wrong. And although that generally kind of shows that they weren't being particularly careful, it also makes it hard to nail them down on anything.
I don't know if I should ask this next question or not, but do you think that that's intentional or just woefully ignorant?
I think this is a volume-based business, and they don't have the time that each patient needs, and they're not expecting to provide much postoperative care or really treat anything serious that arises, and they're just banking on this not happening.
So before you filed suit, were there any meaningful pre-suit settlement discussions?
The short of the story is that we didn't get an offer at all ever before trial. No offers were ever made. All we got was a verdict in this case, but we did try. We tried to engage in discussions under Candor, which was passed in 2019. It allows an opportunity to resolve cases without having the implications for the doctor's license. And so I see this as a really exciting opportunity to resolve Med-Mal cases early, when otherwise they're going to go the distance to protect the doctor's license. But they declined to participate in Candor, and they declined our offers of settlement all throughout trial. In fact, the only offer that we ever got from them was that they would not pursue my client's costs if we dismiss the case before trial.
So my question is, medical malpractice cases are obviously very expensive. And like you said, they often, it seems, no offers, or if they do, they come very, very late. So how hard was it for you and your firm to sort of push forward with this case, given your firm, you know, your firm is relatively new at this point?
This case was everything for us. I had everything invested in this. I'm not going to say I was betting the firm, but I also don't know how I would have moved forward had this gone against us. Wow. And so I'd been funding everything personally. I started this out of my mom's basement. And so this really was a massive investment for us. And based on the odds, I couldn't justify it. But I believed in the client. I wanted to see her case through. And I wanted to deliver this outcome for her. And I'm so grateful that she trusted us too.
Wow. Talk about something that you are never going to forget for the rest of your life. It is going to be this case and what you did. Holy cow. So let's talk a little bit about, in generally speaking, what was the defense? Was the defense, if they're saying, you know, the standard of care is kind of murky, maybe it's 1 hour, maybe it's two, although I think you were saying everyone agreed that antibiotics every hour. So how were they defending this? It was just reasonable actions on the part of the doctor?
Yeah. So the optometrist said that he actually ruled out an infection when he saw her that, you know, Thursday after surgery, because he examined her. He didn't see any sign of an infiltrate. And so he says that he ruled out an infection on that day. And so when the ER called the following day, he didn't need to re-examine her because an infection had been ruled out the previous day. And so they were kind of banking on that part of it. And then from the surgeon side of things, they were saying that he didn't know anything. Nobody contacted him. And so he couldn't have done anything because he didn't have any knowledge or information about what was going on.
So I guess then, was there a strategic reason to not go after the corporation and really try to hone it in on the doctor? Because I guess when I'm hearing you say that, I think, okay, well, if it was a systemic issue, then that defense wouldn't fly. So was it strategic reason to name only the doctor?
Yeah. In Colorado, there's no corporate practice of medicine. And so as much as they like to blame the corporation, you know, once you're litigating against the doctors, if you had filed against the corporation, they would have, you know, cried about that too. And so that's really the biggest reason.
Makes sense. So sort of knew that this was the defense coming in. Tell us a little bit about your themes and how you plan to present this case.
Yeah, my greatest fear was that the jury was going to get confused or not have certainty, because there's a lot of uncertainty about every aspect of this case. And really, this case is about the week after surgery, because after that week, there's nearly a year in which the surgeon proceeds to try and treat her. And she already has permanent scarring at that point. He can't really do anything. But, you know, the treatment goes on and on and on and on. And so I was trying to focus the case on just that week after surgery. And I was trying to make the medicine as simple as possible. And the congruency between when you remove the outermost layer of the eye, it takes a week to heal, and everything important in this case happened in that week after surgery, that gave me a really narrow, focused, you know, digestible bit of medicine and knowledge for the jurors to understand and stick to.
So tell me a little bit about what the actual damage was, and because you mentioned that your client had treated for a year afterwards. What were they trying to do to help her? I'm just not familiar with this type of injury at all, so I'm just curious.
So the damage, put simply, is corneal scarring. Because of the eye infection, her corneas are scarred. And that affects her vision in two ways. One, when she looks through her corneas, when her normal vision, she's looking through scar tissue. It's not clear, perfect tissue. It's cloudy, scarred tissue, which obscures her vision. And that also messes with your vision a second way, because it misshapes the cornea. And so when the cornea isn't shaped properly, then it's affecting your vision in another way as well. And so that was what I really wanted the jurors to understand, because it's very easy for the defense to say that she has 20/20 vision. That's true. That was the biggest hurdle that we had to get over. She has scleral contact lenses, and with those, she has 20/20 vision. So I had to explain what's wrong with scleral contact lenses.
Yeah, I've never even heard of them. What are they and what's wrong with them?
They're not like the contact lenses that most people think of. It's like a prosthetic cornea. It's a big piece of plastic that has to sit over your eye. It has to be taken out repeatedly throughout the day. You have to apply artificial tears. It's itchy. It's uncomfortable. And you can't wear it for long periods of time. And so it's not a good replacement for your natural vision. And it didn't enable her to do things that she did before, such as, you know, work with computers for long periods of time.
Are they expensive, more expensive than regular contacts?
Not really. And that was kind of another problem with our case, because one treatment option for her is a corneal transplant. They can do bilateral corneal transplants. They're not that expensive. And if it works, it technically solves the problem and cures the damages. But she was understandably terrified of having another surgery after a simple one went so horribly wrong. And the risks of corneal transplants are horrifying. Your corneas can literally melt.
So I've dealt with a lot of cases in litigation where we've had to address failure to mitigate defenses when the defense is trying to say that you should have done X, Y, and Z. And so I'm pretty familiar with the case law that says that you don't have to do anything invasive. Were you successful in keeping the defense from making that kind of argument, or did it kind of come in anyway through the back door?
It came in a little bit through the back door. I mean, we strongly argue there's no duty to undergo surgery, but they still discussed that option as if it were a perfect solution. And so it was very important to educate the jurors as to the problems and risks with corneal transplants. And it really can set you on a path where if you have one, you're probably going to have at least two more over the course of your life. And each one increases the risk of rejection. So it's a very scary path to start going down.
Did you ask for the cost of those potential surgeries down the road as part of your damages?
Yeah, that was a component of our damages, but it was relatively small. You know, part of me wishes that this was more expensive treatment, because it's just not the solution to her problems in any way.
So what kind of damages, remind the listeners again about what the verdict was? It's a huge seven-figure verdict.
Yeah, we got a $1.2 million verdict. And the majority of her damages were, one, our life care plan, and two, reduced earning capacity. But those were difficulties on both sides because she works really four jobs, and she was only no longer able to do one of those jobs, but she was making more money than ever before. And so I had to work really hard to educate the jury that reduced earning capacity is the loss of the ability. She cannot go back to that job that she had before. She can never go back to that job. This surgery and the corneal scarring has taken away that option, and it chooses what she has to do with the rest of her life. And that's damage in and of itself.
Did you use a damage formula? Because as you're explaining that, I'm like, that makes perfect sense. And I've had similar cases too, where we're trying to figure out how to quantify that. How did you go about suggesting to the jurors they quantify this loss?
So we had two experts. We had an economist who came up with a vocational economic assessment for the client. And that gave us the component of the reduced earning capacity. And then we also had a life care planner who, you know, accounted for everything that she'll need going forward. And the majority of that was really home care and things that she could no longer do due to chemicals like home cleaning, for example.
Okay. So you've got life care plan and loss of earning capacity. Did those damages make up the majority of the 1.27?
Yes. Majority of it was economic damages. And they really split it evenly, pretty much giving us half of what we asked for on both the life care plan and the economic assessment.
Okay, got it. So where did you try this case?
This was in Boulder.
Okay, and how were you able to, did you face any venue issues with being able to file in Boulder on this?
There were no issues, but we did have a decision to make on this case because the majority of the treatment was not in Boulder. In fact, only a single appointment happened in Boulder. But we decided to file in Boulder, in part because of a conversation I had with another CTLA attorney, in which he talked about how educated the jurors are there. And I really wanted educated jurors. I thought they would be less likely to be swayed by confusing defense tactics and more likely to understand the case. And I thought that I could win them over, you know, on the merits.
What about, I love Boulder for the same reason. And the other thing that's nice about Boulder is that the people tend to have more money. So not only are they more educated, but sometimes it seems like they can appreciate the value of money. What did you face as far as defense experts trying to prove up the defense in this case and how to address that during cross?
Yeah, there were originally six defense experts. Only two of them ended up presenting at trial, but they had glowing praise for the care that was provided by the two doctors here. They claimed that they went above and beyond the standard of care. But really what they were trying to defend was the signs and symptoms that she was exhibiting and saying that everything's subjective, because at the end of the day, pain is subjective. And so they're saying that no amount of pain by itself is sufficient to indicate an infection. Rather, you have to look to the eye exam and for other symptoms to correlate with that pain. And so that's really what they were hiding behind as the first part, at least.
So I guess what other signs and symptoms, because I heard you explain before that this was 10 out of 10 worst pain she's ever experienced in her life. And I guess I can understand the argument that pain is subjective, but if someone is experiencing pain of that level and they're reporting that this is the worst pain that they've ever experienced, obviously that seems like a very reliable metric to use to diagnose an infection. So I guess I'm just curious for my own education purposes, if not that subjective measure, do they have to actually go in and do white blood cell counts in each individual eye at the emergency room? Or what were they suggesting was the standard of care here?
Some experts would say that you can't diagnose a corneal infection without doing a culture, which takes 1 to 2 days. But they'll pretty much all agree that you at least have to do a slit lamp exam and look into the eye for evidence of an infection there. The symptoms alone aren't enough.
Okay. And that's not something that your client had done?
Well, that's what they should have done for her. They did that slit lamp exam that first day, and then afterwards they didn't do a culture the next time that they saw her. And so the way that we tried to turn that argument was they should have done more. I'm not saying that this is definitive at this moment, but this is at least a warning sign. This is at least a sign that the surgeon should be contacted or that the surgeon should look into this further, that she do a culture. And so we really used the jury instructions language there to say that this was not reasonably careful what they did.
So I just had a thought about the fact that they should have contacted the surgeon. And then, so was your point that the surgeon did not provide clear instructions to the other facilities to notify him in the event of potential infection like this?
Yeah, and this loops back to why I didn't involve the corporation in the first place, because the medical literature is very strong and very clear that the surgeon is responsible for postoperative care. He may delegate that, but he has supervisory duties, and that's clearly stated and agreed throughout the medical literature. And so we were very strong on the surgeon's responsibility there. And there was what we believe to be improper delegation, which is kind of a whole other side issue in this case, where he was relying on optometrists to handle postoperative care when in Colorado, optometrists by law cannot handle postoperative care.
Now I think it's making a little more sense. So when she went to the emergency room and they called and were reporting the problems, his office never notified him. Is that right?
Right.
The surgeon's office, because he improperly delegated it to other individuals. And so that surgeon, and it's his own office, didn't put in place procedures so that he's notified in a case like this. Is that right?
Exactly.
Okay. See, it's simple. It's making sense to me. It must have made sense to the jury. I'm really curious about your thoughts and feelings going into this first trial and really what you were feeling. Because I think I heard you say before that you started out in your mom's basement. And in my mind's eye, you're sort of put together all the money you can, invested in this most difficult case. Everyone tells you you're crazy. Med-mal cases or defense verdicts, 9 times out of 10, you don't care. You believe in the client. You're going to trial. So I said that, you know, this could be a movie. What were you feeling? What was in your heart walking into that trial?
Passion. I really believed in what I was doing. And even though the client had pretty much been gaslighted since the very beginning, I had gone through everything so carefully and I felt so strongly about their responsibility and I knew how to back it up. But the scariest thing for me, given that this was a big first for me across all fronts, was just not knowing what I don't know. And when you don't know what you don't know, it's really hard to figure out what you need to know in order to fix that. It's a hard pit to be in. And so I tried to compensate by talking to everybody that I could with experience and asking permission to ask dumb questions and reading everything that I could. And one thing that was really helpful, I bought a lot of books from trialguides.com, but I also had my dad's library and he was a medical malpractice attorney. And so going through his books, I had his annotations, his notes in the margins, and it was a really special experience for me where it felt like I was doing exactly what I was supposed to and I was being guided where I needed to go in order to present this case.
Wow. Did you feel your dad's presence with you at all? I know maybe that's a silly question, but I can't imagine that he wasn't there on some level during this.
Yeah, I really felt it. I'm not somebody who tends to get emotional or anything, but I had one moment driving to court in Boulder where I just broke down because I felt really? That presence with me and I felt so strongly about it. And that gave me the reassurance that I need. So I couldn't say I was confident. I was terrified, but I had faith.
I can't imagine how special it must have been for you to open up your dad's, you know, medical books and see his annotations in there. That must have been really cool.
Yeah, it felt like divine intervention. And so I wasn't going to rely on just that. I wanted to do everything else I could to over-prepare as much as possible, but it was really special.
Now, talk to us a little bit about your damage ask here. You said that they gave you about half of what you were asking for your life care plan and others. What was your strategy in terms of what you asked for from the jury?
My strategy with the jury overall was to maintain credibility. I cared more about credibility than anything. And so I didn't want to overask. I wanted to justify everything that I asked for. And so we asked for the, you know, full amount of the life care plan and the full amount of the reduced earning capacity. And the way that I explained that was she doesn't get to come back. We don't know exactly what her costs are going to be going forward, but this is her one shot. And if it ends up costing more, which it very well could, we don't get to come back. And so this is what the experts say is a fair, unbiased estimate of what her future costs are likely to be. And it's been expensive to get here and to put this trial on.
What a fascinating story. I'm wondering about your voir dire. What I'm curious about is it's your first trial. And did you sort of embrace that? I'm thinking of like the Jerry Spence, I'm nervous, this is my first case. Or were you really trying to go in and put those nerves aside as much as you can and just come off like it wasn't your first trial? So my question is, did you embrace first trial or hide first trial?
I definitely hid it from the jurors, but this is an area where I like to say that Nick Rowley is the best mentor I've ever had that I've never met. because he's produced so many guides and materials that really gave me a framework to work with and so many lines and just attitudes that I could work with. And one of those was how you should approach the jurors. He talks about accepting them and loving them rather than looking for reasons to reject them and focusing on that connection and listening to them and making them feel validated, showing that you care about them. And so that was really my approach going into it.
Yeah, so a little brutal honesty, Vaudeer action.
Yeah, although funny story on that.
Yeah, tell me.
The judge gave us a few rules before Vaudeer, and I thought that I was following those, but I went through the whole brutal honesty thing. And at the end of kind of explaining that, I asked the jurors if they would agree to be brutally honest with me. Well, that infuriated the judge because he had asked us not to solicit promise from the jurors. And the example that he gave was promises as to how they'll behave should they be jurors on the case or things that they'll abide by. And I didn't think that I was overstepping by asking them to be honest during voir dire, but he was very furious about that.
Wow, I'm very surprised to hear that as well. I mean, I suppose the judges could be concerned. Do you promise if I prove my case, you're going to give me $10 million or something? But it seems a little unusual. Certainly must have been caught off guard if the judge is all of a sudden jumping down your neck because of that. Was it a complete surprise? Was the judge visibly angry?
He didn't visibly show anger, but okay. You know, didn't hold back in telling me that I had not followed his very clear instruction. And you know, when this is a big first, that's not exactly the encouraging start that you want to have. But nevertheless, brutal honesty was a success. Jurors continued to bring up brutal honesty throughout the case. One time in a question and speaking to them afterwards. And so even though I didn't get to finish doing it, it still had an impact.
So you received during the trial a jury question where they referenced brutal honesty?
Yeah, they asked questions throughout the trial. I honestly love this panel of jurors that we had. They were so engaged. They asked great questions. And that's really what carried me through this case because I continued to feel throughout the case that they were with me based on the insightful questions they asked.
So what was do you remember what the question was where they referenced brutal honesty?
I don't remember it exactly, just that they threw that in there and there's nowhere else that comes from.
I'm a huge fan for that very reason. And it just seems to come up throughout trial. As soon as you introduce it in voir dire that way, then the next thing you know, you're asking defense experts like, well, come on, brutal honesty here. And then it just repeats itself. It's really fantastic. I'm assuming the answer is yes. Did you really go by the trial by human, spend all of your time that you possibly can getting to know your client inside and out to prepare for this?
Absolutely. And I'm so privileged and grateful that I had such a wonderful client for this case. She's truly an incredible human being. I mentioned she has four jobs. One of that is a foster parent. She's raised 30 young women over the course of her life as a single parent. She's adopted two of her foster children as her own. You can't ask for a better client. And it was a privilege to get to know her. I had dinner in her house, before trial, and I really consider them to be family.
Did you find that spending, and I think I know the answer to this question too, but did you find that spending all that time with her really paid tangible dividends in how you presented the case and what you did at trial?
Absolutely. And I think at a fundamental level, just the connection that you have with the client shows to the jurors. My care was not fake. I truly, deeply felt that care. We had that connection. It was not fake. And I think that the details, the little things of seeing how her bathroom is, for example, just the little things that make everything fit together and allow you to understand things in a different way, just all adds together and helps you be a better advocate.
When you mentioned seeing how her bathroom was put together, were there certain ways that she set up things as a result of her eye injury, where the contacts were, or things like that?
Yes. When you have basically no vision, you have to do a lot to continue to do the same things, even in a familiar environment like your home. And so a big dispute in this case was that they wrote in a medical record that she admitted later on that she stopped taking her antibiotic eye drops. And she showed me when I went to her house, how she had those in her bathroom. Her bathroom was perfectly clean. She is an immaculate, organized person. And she had little rubber bands on the bottles so that even in middle of the night with no vision, she could take the right bottle and just had a brilliantly organized system.
Wow. And something that you might not have known had you not been inside her home. Is that right?
Exactly.
Wow. That's absolutely fantastic. The other thing that I'm sensing from you and that you've mentioned a couple of times is that you loved this client. And we all have had clients that we love and others that maybe we don't. But how important is it? I guess maybe a better question is, do you think that it was apparent to that jury how much you cared for your client?
I think so, yes. At every moment, you know, we're looking to each other. We were just a team going into that courtroom. And the two other attorneys at my firm, my wife, Alexa, and Josh Jacobson, an attorney who joined us recently, they were a perfect part of that team and also built this bond with her and her children, her sister. And you just can't fake that. It's so apparent. It's so tangible. And I think that oftentimes the defense fails to do that and shows a stark contrast from what a lack of connection looks like.
Yeah. And even I have found, I don't know if this was your experience, but the whole brutal honesty and the whole way that Nick Rowley does voir dire, who's probably the best in the country at doing voir dire, and then the stark difference with the way defense lawyers do it, it just puts it on such display. Let me ask you this. How effective do you believe the defense voir dire was, and what was sort of their main takeaway?
We were just on completely different wavelengths in terms of what I was looking for and what they were looking for. They seem to have a rigid, we're trying to exclude people that, you know, check certain boxes. So if you've had any vision issues in the past, if you have any disgruntlement with medical providers or, you know, opinions about medical procedures, they were looking for attitudes and people that they could write off on more superficial things. And that was not how we were approaching it at all. I'll give an example of one juror, and he was asked a question and he said, well, it depends on what the evidence says. If she stopped taking her antibiotic eye drops, then I would blame her. So he said something against my client, but I wanted him on my panel immediately because he was looking at the evidence and he was actually saying that that evidence was important beforehand. And I thought that once we actually got to that point and showed him the evidence, that we could get him to our side because he cares about the evidence. That's what he's looking at. And even though he was suggesting going against us during voir dire, I thought that he would come around once he actually saw it because he's looking at that evidence.
Well, that's a brilliant talk about, you know, spot on instincts, because it's very easy to intellectualize why that is so obvious and smart. Because if the juror is saying, well, if they did X, I would hold it against them. Well, if you know that your client didn't do X, then it's almost the converse must be true. Yep. Then he's going to be on your side. Yep. That's brilliant. Awesome. So what was it like? Just give the listeners an idea of what it was like for you and your client when this was all over, when you walked out of that courtroom and justice being achieved and such a marvelous. And this isn't even, what's really cool about your story, honestly, is it's not like it's awesome because it's $50 or $100 million. It's a fantastic result. Don't get me wrong. This is a massive result. But the odds that you had against you, everything that you put into this personally, and then for justice to be obtained, is like you're going to be chasing that feeling for the rest of your career. What was it like when you walked out of that courtroom?
It was surreal and emotional. We walked outside the courtroom and just sat down at a picnic table and didn't do anything for a long time because we were taking it in and talking about it. And she had been told for almost 5 years at this point that she was wrong, that they did everything right. It'd been nothing but denial. And then once litigation started, they'd been blaming her for everything, every step of the way. And so for her to be damaged and then put that back on her, and for her to believe in herself, for me to believe in her, and for finally the jury to believe in her, that there was so much dignity in that. They gave her back so much more than the amount of the verdict. They saw her, they saw what she went through, and they validated that experience. And there's something that's really healing and special about that, aside from the money.
Maybe this is a dumb question, but I mean, are you just like itching? You cannot wait to get back in next case, next trial?
I'm terrified about losing the next trial because after this unlikely victory, I would hate to trip up on the next one. And so I have a lot of confidence, but I'm not blindly confident. My confidence comes from preparation. It comes from the right client, the right case, and putting in the work over a very long period of time. So I don't have any confidence going forward, other than that if you do the work and put in the time, you can achieve it against the odds.
You know, I just got to say that your response to that answer sounds like you had an amazing upbringing from somebody that knew this profession well, because that is, it just feels very spot on. And I'm sure your father's very proud, honestly.
Thank you. That means the world.
Well, Gabriel, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to come on and tell us about this story. It is truly inspirational. And, you know, mental health cases can be so scary, But what I'm hearing from you is simplicity and a righteous client, justice can be done. So congratulations to you, and thank you so much for coming on the show. And until next time, we'll welcome you back to the Colorado Trial Lawyer Connection podcast. We'll have another lawyer come on and talk about an amazing result. So Gabriel, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Keith. It's been an honor.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you've gained valuable insights and inspiration from today's courtroom warriors. And thank you for being in the arena. Make sure to subscribe and join us next time as we continue to dissect real cases and learn from Colorado's top trial lawyers. Our mission is to empower our legal community, helping us to become better trial lawyers to effectively represent our clients. Keep your connection to Colorado's best trial lawyers alive at www.thectlc.com.